CBS News Face the Nation in 60 seconds.
True story. A Seattle man went to bed with nearly $300,000 in his bank account. By morning, the money had vanished because of some identity thief. Can you imagine? What if some thief got to your life savings? Look, no one can stop all identity theft, but here's what I did. I armed my bank and retirement accounts with LifeLock Ultimate Plus. Yep, LifeLock's best just got better. LifeLock Ultimate Plus is the most comprehensive identity theft protection available, helping protect your identity, your bank and retirement accounts, credit cards, even the equity in your home. How many other ID theft protection services do that? Zero. So why risk it? Do what I did. Get LifeLock Ultimate Plus and sleep easier knowing if a thief goes after your identity or life savings, LifeLock's on it. Visit LifeLock.com now and enter promo code Gordon or call and mention Gordon to save 10% on your LifeLock Ultimate Plus membership. 800-916-7170. That's 800-916-7170. 800-916-7170. Network does not cover all transactions.
I'm Bob Schieffer. Today on Face the Nation, terror and turmoil in the Mideast. Another hostage has apparently been executed by the terror group ISIS. In Yemen, the pro-American government has collapsed, giving al-Qaeda a stronger hand there. And chilly relations between the president and Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu turn even colder. We'll talk to White House Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough, Senate Armed Services Committee Chairman John McCain, and the top Democrat on the Intelligence Committee, Senator Dianne Feinstein. Plus, the late weekend developments on the NFL Deflategate controversy, and expert analysis on all of this, because this is Face the Nation. And good morning. It was just a few months ago that the administration was holding up Yemen as the model for fighting terrorism. That is, by supporting partners on the ground and not sending in U.S. ground forces. At a news conference in India this morning, the president declared that is still the right strategy.
Yemen has never been a perfect democracy or a island of stability. The alternative would be for us to play whack-a-mole every time there is a terrorist actor inside of any given country to deploy U.S. troops. And that's not a sustainable strategy.
And we're joined this morning by the White House Chief of Staff, Dennis McDonough, who is here in Washington. And Mr. McDonough, I have to say, while putting a large number of U.S. ground troops into Yemen may not have been the right strategy, obviously the strategy that we've been employing has not worked. What happened? Did we just not see this coming?
Bob, thanks for the opportunity to be with you this morning. I sure appreciate it. Let's remind everybody what the president was saying when he made the remarks a couple months ago that you're referring to. He's saying that given that al-Qaeda is going to hide in dark spaces, take advantage of tumultuous political situations, and really press untrained security forces, the president said we should have a partnership strategy that works for us to press governments in places like Baghdad and Sana'a to make sure that they're making the right political choices. Ultimately, these things get resolved as a political deal among Arab or Muslim actors in the region. That's point one. Point two is we got to make their security forces more effective. That's what we're doing with these training programs, these equipping programs. We have a very good one in Iraq right now that's working very effectively, in my view. And the third thing we have to do is have good intelligence, know that when some threat is manifesting, is going to threaten our people, our interests, or our country, that we take action decisively to do that. What the president was saying when he talked about us doing that successfully in Yemen, he's saying that we are taking out terrorist leaders, as we have in that country and elsewhere in the region. If he has to act, he will, and he's demonstrated that.
But the government fell. I mean, the strategy obviously didn't work, at least. I mean, was this a surprise to U.S. officials? I don't remember any talk about this in the State of the Union message.
Oh, boy, we've been talking about Yemen for a long time, Bob. Going back to the earliest days of the administration, we were very focused on the counterterrorism efforts there because of the brutality and the nefariousness of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, an offshoot of Al-Qaeda Central. Now, we've been very clear that we have a counterterrorism strategy, Bob. That's what we're trying to do, is to make sure that we keep them off kilter. That's why we did things like we did, and it's been acknowledged about Anwar al-Awlaki, for example. That's point one. Well, point two, you keep bringing it back to the government. I think it's very important to recognize that governance in Yemen has always been difficult. We will continue to press actors on the ground, including today, to make decisions transparently, pursuant to a political agreement, so that we can work with them to keep on the offensive against Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. But we can't be responsible for every government in the region. We have to make sure that they're doing that themselves.
I take your point on that. But were we surprised that this government collapsed?
We weren't surprised that that this government collapsed. We knew that this was an ongoing challenge over the course of the last several months. That's why we've been pressing on all the actors to take important steps to address the situation. We're continuing to do that today.
The president said this morning that reports, I think one appeared yesterday in the Washington Post, that the joint terrorism efforts that we had going with Yemen have been curtailed. He said that's simply not accurate. But how could they not be? I mean, the government that we were working with has just fallen. How could that not affect our efforts to try to combat the terrorists?
Important counterterrorism efforts continue. There's no doubt about that. And we will continue to press that. We will also continue to make sure that we have the intelligence that we need to see threats as they manifest. That's the second point. The third point is we will continue to work on the political situation because we know that Al-Qaeda hides in these dark, tumultuous situations to ply their trade. We'll continue to do that. And ultimately, we're going to need our partners in the region to help us clean those spaces out. The best way to do that is strong leadership. And we'll look strong, transparent leadership, and we'll continue to look for that.
Let me ask you about this, because I think this is what bothers a lot of people, and certainly it's what the critics of this administration are talking about. It seems that once again we have been blindsided by events, whether it is the civil war in Syria, whether it is the things that happened in Benghazi, whether it is suddenly the emergence of ISIS. It always seems to come as a surprise. Why is that?
Well, I disagree with the premise of the question, Bob. We've obviously been investing enormous effort in Yemen, as we have in Iraq against ISIL, in Syria as well. The point here is, Bob, is that we are going to continue to see tumultuous political situations. We ought to make sure that we're pressing on the leaders in those countries to resolve them transparently and pursuant to their constitutional processes. We'll continue to do that. We'll also continue to help them prepare, train, and equip their security forces so they can take the fight to these forces in their own countries. After all, they're the biggest victims of their perfidy and of their hateful actions. And the third thing we'll continue to do is where we need to act to protect our own interests, we'll do that. This president's proven he'll do it. He'll do it when he needs to.
You know what your critics say. They say that you're downplaying these incidents because they don't conform to the narrative you would like to construct here, and that is that we're winning this war on terrorism, which you don't even call a war anymore.
Well, we say we're in a war against Al-Qaeda. We just never said we've been in a war against terrorism, which is a tactic. It's an unusual thing to say that we're at war against a tactic. We are, however, at war against Al-Qaeda. Its manifestations in Yemen, its manifestations in South Asia, its manifestations in East Africa, North Africa, and we're at war bound to ultimately destroy, first defeat, then destroy ISIL in Iraq and Syria. So, Bob, we're not downplaying anything. We're investing an enormous amount of time and resources, including an enormous amount of resources that the American people make available to us and an enormous amount of our troops in this effort. So we'll continue to do that.
What about this situation now with Israel, where John Boehner, the speaker, invited Benjamin Netanyahu to come and speak to a joint session of the Congress? The White House, again, had no idea that this was coming. Some people in the White House are being quoted on background as saying the Israelis spit in our face on this.
I want to be careful. That's a quote that was attributed to an administration official, not to the White House, and that's not something that either I clear you know or I'm comfortable it? With, I do not. And not only do I not know who said it, but it does not reflect the views of this president or of this White House. That's point one. Point two is the president has taken pains, because of the importance of this relationship, to make clear that it is above partisan politics. We will continue to do that. Third, the breadth of this relationship goes from our important cultural values, shared values, all the way through intelligence cooperation, defense, and security cooperation. Well, and that will continue. What we won't allow us to do is let us become an issue in their elections. That's why the president was clear this week. We should not meet with Prime Minister Netanyahu just 2 weeks before his election.
Well, was the president offended by this?
I'm not going to get into the back and forth on that up on the Hill. That's something between the Speaker and the Prime Minister, apparently.
I guess you wish he hadn't have done it.
Oh, you know, I don't spend a lot of time wishing or hoping. What I do is I confront situations that I'm dealt with.
All right.
All right.
Mr. McDonough, it's always good to have you.
Great to see you, Bob.
Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to now get probably the other side of this story. We're going to Phoenix, and the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, John McCain. Senator McCain, you had a chance to listen to Mr. McDonough. What is your reaction to what you just heard him say?
I'm afraid that he and the president have lost touch with reality. Iran is on the march throughout. In Yemen, it's not AQAP that's taken over the government. It's the Houthis, who, guess what, are backed and supported by the Iranians. The Iranians are now either dominant or extremely influential in Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, Yemen. They're on the move in Bahrain, and they are winning. And there is no... I did not hear Mr. McDonough articulate a strategy except that we will fight against these people, which is nice to know. But when you look at the map, the Iranians are on the march, AQAP, and the ISIS in both Iraq and Syria are doing quite well. There is no strategy to defeat them. For example, in Kobani, we have been bombing Kobani for months with the U.S. air power, and they're still there. ISIS continues to consolidate their position and attract thousands of young people from all over the world. And believe me, I agree with the director of British intelligence, MI5, who gave a speech last week saying that these young people, mainly from other countries that are now in Iraq and Syria, are a direct threat to the United States of America and Great Britain. So there is no strategy. It is delusional for them to think that what they're doing is succeeding. And we need more boots on the ground. I know that's a tough thing to say and a tough thing for Americans to swallow, but it doesn't mean the 82nd Airborne. It means forward air controllers. It means special forces. It means intelligence, and it means other capabilities. And for them to say, we expect them to do it on their own, they're not doing it on their own, and they are losing.
Well, Senator, you know and I know that if you walked up to two or three people standing on the street in any city in America, chances are they would not be talking about what the latest news is from Yemen. It's just something that people don't talk about all that much. But how important is this, what's happening there?
I think it's extremely important because it's part of this scenario where Iranian influence is on the march. The radical Islam, despite the fact that Mr. McDonough still refuses to acknowledge it, they think they're in a war with us, so I don't see any reason why we wouldn't agree with the French that we are in a war against radical Islam, and they are succeeding. And I agree with you that most Americans don't know much about Yemen, but they do know what they see in these beheadings that are going on, both of Americans and the latest with the Japanese. We have seen American public opinion dramatically grow as they begin to appreciate the nature of this threat. I'd like to mention one other thing, too, and that is Ukraine. Obviously, as many of us predicted, Vladimir Putin is now trying to take Mariupol, a city that's major when you look at a land bridge to Crimea in eastern Ukraine. The question is now, does Vladimir Putin move over to Moldova? He is already putting enormous pressure on the Baltic states, and we shamefully refuse to give them weapons, the Ukrainians weapons to defend themselves, while Grad rockets, obviously from the Russians, are now killing innocent men, women, and children in Ukraine? I mean, this is another shameful chapter, and I'm embarrassed, frankly embarrassed.
Well, do you think the administration is playing down some of these episodes because it doesn't fit the story they would like to be telling about how things are going on the terrorism front?
Well, anyone who just viewed Mr. McDonough's performance, and I'm a friend of his, would certainly, I think, draw the conclusion that Mr. McDonough's description of events are certainly contradicted by the situation on the ground, particularly in the Middle East. But again, in Ukraine, this is really very, very serious what Putin has done. And it's not the first time that a dictator, because of domestic problems, has committed acts of aggression to divert the attention of his people. In the Middle East, we have got to have boots on the ground. We have got to have training capability. And one of the other things we've got to do is we can't train young people in Syria and send them back into Syria to be barrel bombed by Bashar Assad. That's also immoral. We have to have a no-fly zone and a buffer zone if we are going to be able to prevail against both ISIS and Bashar Assad. And by the way, we are leaving Bashar Assad alone, which is, again, incredible. The man who's responsible for well over 200,000 people murdered.
Can I ask you quickly the situation with Benjamin Netanyahu? Where do you come down on that?
I come down on that relations have never been worse between ourselves and the only genuine democracy in the entire Middle East. They are convinced that these negotiations with Iran will lead to Iranian acquisition of a nuclear weapon, which will then nuclearize the entire Middle East, and that will be a direct threat to the existence of the State of Israel. I regret that the relations have deteriorated to this degree, but I do believe that it's important that Prime Minister Netanyahu speak to the American people. And by the way, we need congressional ratification of any agreement that is made. This is too big to be left to not be treated as a treaty.
All right. Senator John McCain, the new chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. We'll be back in 1 minute with Senator Dianne Feinstein, ranking Democrat on the Intelligence Committee.
True story, a Seattle man went to bed with nearly $300,000 in his bank account. By morning, the money had vanished because of some identity thief. Can you imagine? What if some thief got to your life savings? Look, no one can stop all identity theft, but here's what I did. I armed my bank and retirement accounts with LifeLock Ultimate Plus. Yep, LifeLock's best just got better. LifeLock Ultimate Plus is the most comprehensive identity theft protection available, helping protect your identity, your bank and retirement accounts, credit cards, even the equity in your home. How many other ID theft protection services do that? Zero. So why risk it? Do what I did. Get LifeLock Ultimate Plus and sleep easier knowing if a thief goes after your identity or life savings, LifeLock's on it. Visit LifeLock.com now and enter promo code Gordon or call and mention Gordon to save 10% on your LifeLock Ultimate Plus membership. 800-916-7170. That's 800-916-7170. 800-916-7170. Network does not cover all transactions.
Back now with the top Democrat on the Intelligence Committee, of course, a longtime chairman when the Democrats were in the majority. Well, Senator, you heard Senator McCain, you heard Dennis McDonough. Where do you come down on all this?
Oh, wow. You know, I agree with some of the things that Senator McCain said and Mr. McDonough as well. Let me tell you where I come down on it. I think our intelligence with respect to what's going to happen in many of these countries is weak. Whether it's because we do not have adequate human intelligence or not, I don't know. But we've seen, McCain is right, we've seen this happen a number of times. We certainly saw it with the Ukraine and the taking of the Crimea, and now what happened with the Houthis. And
in Yemen.
In Yemen, right. And with respect there, no one knows what's going to happen. The future is unknown, which really should not be the case. We know that The Houthis have said they would leave us alone, and yet their slogan is death to America, death to Israel. They have deposed the president. The military has separated off. We have less than 300 Yemeni military guarding our embassy. So I think there are a number of priorities there. One is to see that our people are safe. The second is to take a good look at our policy with respect to Yemen. And it's largely counterterrorism. It's largely developed against al-Qaeda because al-Qaeda is coming after us. They've tried to get four of these bombs that go through magnetometers into our country. So it's targeting the leadership and trying to take that leadership out. Now, that's what comes through to people. My concern is, where is Iran going? Iran has been supporting the Houthis. Is Iran trying to begin the development of an Iranian crescent? I don't know. But I think we have to think long term, and I think we have to become much more, develop the human side of intelligence rather than the technical side
of intelligence. Do you think the president is too cautious on foreign policy?
I think this is very difficult because the president, to an extent, is in a difficult position. The American people don't want another war. There's been two Iraq wars. There's been one Afghan war. They don't see it. It's in a foreign land. It's far and apart from them. So this is very difficult. I do think that we need to look more deeply and broadly into what we're doing and how we're doing it. I think the deteriorate and destroy of ISIL has had some victory. I don't know whether 6,000 ISIL people have been killed or not, but that's the figure that's floating around. But that's not going to do it. And so where McCain is right, I do think we need some special operations in these countries, on the ground, more than just advisors. And I think we need to protect our allies. That's Israel, that's Jordan, that's Saudi Arabia, and be more pronounced about it.
We've been focused on the Middle East because of these latest incidents, but hadn't heard much about Afghanistan lately. How are things going there?
Well, I happen to know the new president somewhat, and he is called, and I know Dr. Abdullah, and I think he's made a good start. However, I think the Taliban's going to try to come back, and it looks like al-Qaeda in Pakistan is now trying to come back into Afghanistan. So I'll be very candid, I'm one of those Democrats that doesn't see a rapid pullout of American troops as being beneficial. Now, the president has added some troops to the 9,000. I guess it's up to around 10,800 remaining. I think that's good, but I think they have to be very cognizant, A, of the Taliban, and B, of al-Qaeda coming back.
And then to go back to the Middle East just quickly, do you envision we might have to put more ground or have to put ground troops back into the Middle East?
Well, this is one thing that I've tried to follow carefully, particularly with respect to Syria. And I don't see what we're doing making a difference. So I think we need to relook at this. And if we are going to tolerate Assad, as McCain said, and I tend to agree, looks like is the case, that's a problem. Initially, the point was to do this to the extent that you got both Iran and Russia to help us bring the Syrians to the table and have a political solution. I think most people still believe a political solution is necessary, but nobody's trying to effect it.
All right, we have to end it there.
Thank you.
Senator, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was in all the papers. You probably saw it sandwiched amidst all the other more important news. It ranged from awful to terrible, and it made me a little sad. SkyMall, that catalog of oddball stuff we used to find on every airplane, is going out of business. Another victim of iPhones and iPads. The catalog once had the world's largest captive audience. Airline passengers looking for an excuse not to talk to the know-it-all in the other seat. Instead, we could peruse the catalog of products that ranged from the statue of Bigfoot to life-size suits of armor built to stand smartly in a corner of the family den. Now we can just lose ourselves in the electronic devices. Too bad, really. I log many airline hours fantasizing about what my wife and kids would say if something from the catalog, maybe the mounted squirrel head, showed up at our house. Oh, Dad. For years, I planned to buy the pink flamingos on a stick and plant them some night in the yards of chosen friends. But I never did, and now it's too late. Time marches on, tastes change. I don't think the catalog's latest edition even included flamingos. I'm going to miss that catalog. Back in a minute.
Do you want to learn how to steal customer credit card information from major retailers so you can buy anything you want?
Well, we can't help you with that. But among the many IT problems we solve, Barracuda's award-winning firewalls prevent hackers from taking your valuable data to the bank. Reclaim your network like 150,000 other businesses have. To learn more about protecting customer data and your reputation, visit barracuda.com/firewalls.
Welcome back to Face the Nation, and if you've been within 100 miles of a television set or a radio, you know there's another story that's been dominating the headlines this week. Whether or not the New England Patriots deliberately deflated 11 of the footballs they used against the Indianapolis Colts in the AFC Championship game earlier this month. Patriots coach Bill Belichick told reporters yesterday the team had investigated, and he says they did nothing wrong.
At no time was there any intent whatsoever to try to compromise the integrity of the game or to gain an advantage.
So we turn now to Jared Bell, the NFL columnist for USA Today. He is in Phoenix, the site of Super Bowl 49. And Jared, I have to tell you, we invited you just so I could ask you this question. Did his comments yesterday deflate this whole controversy?
Oh, not in the least, because some people are now disputing his theory on a scientific level. And you have to wonder, Bob, about the other team's footballs. So Belichick has his explanation. And on one level, Bob, it's interesting that they conducted their investigation and they came to that conclusion in 3 days, and the NFL is still going to have this long, drawn-out investigation. So he kind of gave it to the league on that level. But the fundamental question is, okay, if the weather conditions affected the Patriots' balls, what about the footballs used by the Indianapolis Colts? And that's at the root of this issue. And it's going to be here all week. It's the Super Bowl, super hype. So here we go.
I mean, what are we going to have to do here? Are referees going to have to carry around those little pressure gauges like we carry, in our car to see if our tires are carrying the right amount of air? And basically what he was saying was that when the balls are inside where it's warm, hot air expands, they weigh one thing. When you get them outside in the cold weather, they weigh something else. I mean, I don't know what to make of this.
Yeah, again, I think that's somewhere to go when you start thinking about, you know, what really happened. Because remember, the officials, and I think it was interesting that Belichick did point out that the officials are actually the ones who inflate the balls to 12.5 pounds per square inch 2 hours before the game. And so that's their responsibility to make sure the balls are at a certain level. And then, so conceivably, they did that. They inspected these balls before the game. And what happened from there, we don't know. We just know that the Patriots' balls were supposedly different than the Colts' footballs. So explain that.
Well, you know, I mean, maybe this is a baseball fan in me coming out, but I mean, in baseball, the umpires are responsible for the ball. When somebody's been cutting the ball or rubbing it up, the umpire's the one that calls that. Shouldn't the officials be the ones who decide if these balls are okay?
Yeah, once the game starts, actually, the officials are the ones. And if you remember what happened in the game, they took one ball out of play, and then went to halftime to inspect the balls, and then for the second half, you know, all of the balls were up to snuff, if you will. It's interesting because you go back to 1999, Bob, when the NFL actually changed this policy to allow the teams to have more access to the footballs. Before 1999, the home team provided all of the footballs, and there was a push to allow the visiting teams to bring their balls, and you know, the teams like to break these balls in during practice, and you don't want a brand new football. So that was kind of the impetus towards setting it up the way it is now. But yeah, there are so many unexplained questions to this still, despite what Belichick said. And I think this whole story obviously relates to the fact that the Patriots have pushed the envelope so many times over the years on a number of different levels, not all of them illegal, but a lot of things that have raised questions about whether or not they will do anything at any cost to win. And the big one is Spygate, which they definitely were found guilty of violating NFL rules.
All right, Jared. Well, I think I'm kind of like Coach Belichick. I agree with him on one thing. I'm ready to move on from this story. And my sense is, I guess this gives us an idea of the role and the place of football in American culture these days that we're even talking about this morning. Thank you very much for being with us this morning, Jared. Oh. We're going to turn now to our panel. Susan Page, of course, is a Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Dana Milbank, a columnist for The Washington Post. Jeffrey Goldberg, national correspondent for The Atlantic. We're also joined by Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico, and CBS News political director John Dickerson. Michael, let me just start with you. This situation in Yemen, how could we not have seen this coming?
Well, Bob, there are so many moving parts in Yemen. I'm sympathetic to the administration trying to keep their arms around a country that a lot of experts describe as basically a failed state. So for several years now, we've been primarily worried about the Al-Qaeda franchise in Yemen, known as Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Perhaps the most dangerous terror group in the world. We talk a lot about ISIS, but these are the guys that put the underwear bomber on a plane on Christmas Day 2009, have inspired some other near-miss attacks, and had ties to the massacre in Paris this month. So we were really focused on counter-terror operations against AQAP, but now you have this insurgency that has little to do with America, has to do with internal tribal and sectarian dynamics in that country. And I think it just came faster and harder than we expected. The government was more fragile than we expected. And now those counterterror operations against Al-Qaeda, as a result of the government basically collapsing, appear to be on hold or close to it. And that has real consequences for American security.
Jeffrey Goldberg, but that's the way it always seems to be lately. It always happens, and then we're surprised.
Right. I mean, Mosul fell in Iraq to ISIS, and we were shocked. People said it was coming for a year before that. There's the broader question here is that what we see over and over again in the greater Middle East is more and more countries are becoming ungoverned spaces. Yemen has always had an Al-Qaeda problem, but now the entire country could fall under the control of a group that can use that territory to plot attacks against America. We have that across a broad swath of Iraq and Syria right now. Obviously, Pakistan and Afghanistan are problematic, and so Libya, of course, is collapsing on itself. So we have a situation in which the president could be leaving office in January of 2017 with hundreds of thousands of square miles of the greater Middle East under the control of terrorists plotting against the West. Terrible problem.
Susan, is this an example of what the president's critics are calling leading from behind?
Well, it could be. And, you know, the president would very much like to talk about how the economy's getting better and how the Affordable Care Act is working for some Americans. But he is forced to deal over and over again with these foreign policy crises. And we heard not only criticism from Senator McCain in your interview, but from Senator Feinstein, another Democrat, saying, expressing concern about the fact that intelligence failures here in Ukraine and elsewhere.
Go ahead, Dana.
Think about the extraordinary disconnect we saw this week. So we began with a State of the Union address that was about broadband and community colleges. You know, he didn't mention the word Al-Qaeda, certainly didn't mention Saudi Arabia or Yemen. He gave all of, I think, 65 words to counterterrorism at all. And then you see it's been completely overtaken. So I think, as the president said Tuesday night, he wants to turn the page. He's saying the crisis, the shadow of crisis has passed. But you can't just make it so by saying it. And you see them and sucked back in by Islamic State and the beheading, sucked back in by the Saudi king's death, and sucked back in by Yemen and now Egypt.
And also in the State of the Union, the president talked about his foreign policy as being deliberate, measured, a little bit smarter than maybe his critics had suggested. But what those critics are now saying is this deliberation that the president boasted about in his State of the Union, there is a kind of a sleep at the switch quality. He had mentioned Yemen when he was talking about U.S. operations in Iraq and Syria. He held Yemen up as the model. And so what their critics are now saying is, wait, you're holding up a country that's a model that's now fallen. You just are not aware of what's going on. They also point to other instances where he referred to ISIS, the threat from those kinds of terrorists, as being like the JV team. And that's where this is particularly damaging, because it's a question of really whether the administration knows what's going on.
And, you know, Jeffrey, the president said just this morning in his news conference in India, he said that these reports that we are having to curtail some of our efforts against al-Qaeda in Yemen, he said those reports are simply not accurate. Well, how could they not be accurate when the government we were working with has just fallen?
Well, they might not be accurate at this moment, but in the coming days and weeks, it's going to be harder and harder for the U.S. to operate in Yemen. The force that seems to be taking over is a pro-Iranian force that has actually, although it's fighting al-Qaeda, also has come out against the use of drones. They are anti-American. They chant things like death to America in the streets. It's going to be harder and harder even to maintain an embassy and maintain any kind of presence in Yemen, and it's going to be ungoverned space. So I think it's going to be, if it's not true at the moment, it's going to be true if things continue
and
as they are.
Those operations had already been slowing down. According to data compiled by the New America Foundation, we conducted 56 drone strikes and airstrikes in Yemen in 2012. Last year, the number was 17 or 19, and I believe there have been three since mid-September. So as that government was destabilizing already, our cooperation with their military in this counterterror effort was slowing way down.
And let me go back to you, Jeffrey, because I think you are one of the most informed people that I know of, certainly among reporters, on Israel and the situation there. What do you make of this thing of the John Boehner, apparently with the help of Ron Dermer, the U.S. ambassador, who, by the way, used to be on the staff of Newt Gingrich,
right,
before he became an Israeli citizen, inviting Prime Minister Netanyahu to come here, the White House, again, totally blindsided by all of this. Is this a serious thing? Is it just something that is serious and is bogged down in both domestic politics there and here?
Right.
Or what's this all about?
Right. Well, we've known for a while that the relationship between Netanyahu and Obama is kind of like the marriage from hell. They can't get out of it, but they're stuck with each other. This has been a very, very strange episode. It's as if the Israeli government forgot that John Boehner is not the commander-in-chief. I mean, they're treating Boehner as if he has control over U.S. foreign policy and national security policy. It makes absolutely no sense, and I think that at this point we're looking at a situation in which the relationship between Netanyahu and Obama, who of course is the guy who's going to ultimately have to defend Israel if the Iran situation gets out of control, is frayed beyond repair, and so it's inexplicable to me why they're going down this path.
Extraordinary consequences to this, I think. I mean, people across America may think, well, what's the big deal? But consequences for the U.S.-Israeli relationship, consequences to the Boehner-Obama relationship. This is really an extraordinary breach of the way things are supposed to work when it comes to foreign policy in this country. And let's not forget that Netanyahu is going to come here to lobby for a bill that is before Congress on tougher Iranian sanctions that the president has threatened to veto. That is also extraordinary for a foreign leader to come here and get enmeshed in a battle that's before the American people, before the American legislature. This is really, really consequential.
I'm seriously considering the possibility of running.
If I was too blunt, too direct, too loud, and too New Jersey for Iowa, then why do you people keep inviting me back?
It can't be Mitt, because Mitt ran and failed. He failed. The last thing we need is another Bush. I am seriously thinking of running for president because I can do the job.
I've been thinking a little about 2016.
Hey, let's also take the sign off the door to the Oval Office, you know, that one that said for a while, no girls allowed.
I'm pleased to be here in Iowa today. I'm going to come back many more times in the future.
My name is Mike Lee. I'm from Utah,
and I'm not running for president.
And he may be the only person in the United States Senate that would make that statement. Well, you were out there, John.
It was a big event. There were more than 20 speakers. It was to the absolute conservative part of the Republican Party. It was kind of the sort of Sky Mall of political events, a lot of variety, and wasn't quite sure how everyone fit in. Donald Trump, for example, gets a big reception there. He says a lot of exciting things, but he's not likely to be president. The most interesting part about this is who did the best for themselves in terms of what they actually have to do in the long march. It's 2 years away, really, until the election. But the caucuses in Iowa, that kickoff event, is just a year away. And so all the major candidates are scrambling for staff. And I think Scott Walker did himself probably the best at this event because he spoke to the crowd there. They were very excited to hear about his Wisconsin record. The conservatives in there, they liked him. But there was nothing he said that will show up later and seem sort of out of touch. And that's the challenge for any candidate showing up when you're talking to the base of the base, because you say things they love, but which may not play all the way to a general election. And that's a challenge for any party, but particularly the Republican Party, how to have the base like the candidate, but then also have that candidate go all the way through to November of 2016.
You know, Reince Priebus, the chairman of the Republican Party, has been very worried about this large field because he, you know, felt like that these candidates chewed themselves up the last time in all those debates. But Dana Milbank, this looks like you've closed your eyes and awakened in heaven.
Oh, when I saw that Donald Trump might run, I had that feeling. And it is like Sky Mall in the large number, but also the exotic offerings. I mean, you have the equivalent of the suit of armor and the flamingos and the Bigfoot out there right
Who's
now.
Who's the Bigfoot?
Well, there's a couple of people vying for Bigfoot. I'm not going to make a Chris Christie joke. You're not going to lure me into that. But, you know, this is the Cantaloupe Calves Caucus right now. Do you realize that for the first major event of this election season, the guy's name on the lectern that you just said, Steve King, this is the guy who said that the Dreamers were these drug mules with calves the size of cantaloupes, likened immigrants to dogs, talked about a woman in the First Lady's box at the State of the Union being deportable. This is why Jeb Bush isn't there. This is why Mitt Romney isn't there. And is this really the way they want to kick off their 2016 by poisoning the well with the most important demographic group in America?
Well, think about the person who wasn't there, Jeb Bush, who instead gave us a very serious speech in California about his laying out his position on things and saying he wants to have an adult conversation. And the only problem with that is I was trying to remember the last time the candidate who wanted to have an adult conversation actually won the nomination in either party. I mean, that'd be like Bruce Babbitt or Paul Tsongas. The adult conversation does not usually gin up the base of either party. And I wonder about the problem that Jeb Bush might face with just Bush fatigue. There was a focus group that Peter Hart did about 2 weeks ago of a dozen swing voters in Denver. There was a lot of feeling that they were tired of Jeb Bush. They were tired of Hillary Clinton. The people these swing voters liked were Rand Paul and Elizabeth Warren.
And when you say you're having an adult conversation, or you need to have an adult conversation, what you're essentially saying is that the conversation everybody else has is in a conversation of children. And so these are activists not disposed to Jeb Bush or Mitt Romney. So to call them children excites their anger. What Chris Christie was trying to do is he's not going to win over that audience. I talked to a lot of people there who are highly skeptical of Chris Christie. They think he's too moderate. But he's showing that he at least respects their views. He's trying to build a bridge to those people. And that's usually the ticket. You know, you have to not be somebody who takes all of their anger. And during yesterday, anyway, Mitt Romney and Jeb Bush got the anger, not Chris Christie.
And, you know, my favorite event of the week was Larry King may not be on CNN anymore, but he runs into Mitt Romney in the airport. And Romney tells him that he'll decide in 2 weeks whether or not he's going to run. Now, that is legitimate news there. So old Larry,
well,
still at it.
Shoe leather reporter.
And Romney's feeling his oats a little bit, Bob. I did a story on this a week or two ago. Romney is a key part of his case is that he's been vindicated in his terms on foreign policy. He says, I was warning that Putin was this huge threat to global stability in the 2012 campaign, and I got made fun of for talking about a new Cold War. Well, you know, Time magazine, when I was there, had a cover Cold War II several months ago. He was saying that President Obama was a little too confident about the retreat of al-Qaeda, and he was saying Islamic radicalism is spreading, and they're just as dangerous as ever. So it'll be really interesting to see the foreign policy debate here, particularly because voters voters care more about it now than they did in the last election cycle. I think it's going to be a more salient issue.
Let me tell you something else, and we can come back to Republicans. But turning to the Democratic side, there's no question that Hillary Clinton is the overwhelming favorite. But you know what? People are telling me that Joe Biden is really seriously looking and trying to figure out some way to run, and is telling people he thinks he can raise $30 to $50 million.
Well, I talked to someone who's close to do it. Biden just last night, who said that if Hillary Clinton runs, there is no way Joe Biden runs, but if she doesn't run, there is no way he's not going to run.
He'd like it to fall into his lap. He'd like to be anointed,
as they all would like.
Much like Mitt Romney would like to be anointed, and well, he should. I mean, this looks the way it's shaping up, the way the economy is going, this looks to be a very good year for the Democrats if it continues the way it is. And there's the whole lineup of them, whoever it is going to be in a very strong position.
I would say, look, as a profession, we are, of course, praying for a Joe Biden candidacy. You want some excitement on the Democratic side.
Sanders.
And, well, of course, that goes without saying. But, you know, I would say that it does look like a good year, except if this situation that we've been talking about from that swath of countries running from Libya to Yemen, all the way into Pakistan, Afghanistan, if that goes south in some terrifying way, these Republicans who are sounding, as you point out, very steroidal already on foreign policy, are going to have much more to go with.
You know, and one thing from Iowa, when you talk to people who would like Hillary Clinton to be president, they'd like her to have a challenger. They remember what happened in 2008, that she got a lot better when she was fighting against Barack Obama. And if she doesn't have a test, also, by the way, we should note, everybody in Iowa wants everybody to run because it means they come to Iowa, and the governor of Iowa, Terry Branstad, said finally yesterday when he was pressed on it, he said, it's good for the economy. So they all want them to come there. They want Hillary Clinton to have a challenger, to sharpen her message so that she has a good, strong message for the general election.
And to Jeff's point, a major overseas crisis could derail everything that's shaping up for the Democrats. But Obama's numbers have been plummeting on foreign policy, yet his overall numbers are still rising. And that's because it's not just the president and the Congress. Americans don't care a jot about foreign policy.
Well, that's the question I think we have to ask. We see these horrible things that are happening, and it's one after the other. But will that be a part of the campaign in 2016?
I think if Americans feel they want the president, they may care more about the economy than foreign policy, but they want the president to be up to the job of leading the United States in a difficult world. And you think about what undid Jimmy Carter more than anything else. That was a foreign policy crisis, not a domestic one, although he had his domestic troubles as well.
And finally, I want to end this conversation. We found out during one of the commercial breaks that someone actually did one time buy something from the SkyMall catalog, and it was our own Jeffrey Goldberg.
Thank you for outing me in front of a national television. Yes, not. I bought it, actually. I bought it twice, to be honest with you. I bought the polyurethane Ten Commandments that, fantastic, weighs about 30 pounds, and I use it as a prop in our Passover Seder, which is a very effective prop. Carry it down the stairs, and it's a wonderful, by the way, indestructible. Totally, it'll outlive SkyMall, put it that way.
If I could interject as a representative of the Bezos media empire, the yard flamingos are available on Amazon for $11.49.
All right, we have to end there. Thank you all very much. Well, that's it for us today, and we'll see you right here next week. Today's guests were White House Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough and Senators John McCain and Dianne Feinstein. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. The senior producers are Rob Hendon and Jill Jackson. This broadcast was directed by Sue Ann Stocky Wayne. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com, and you can follow Face the Nation, Bob Schieffer, and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.